Friday, friends. Greg Kogel here for Stand to Reason, and I am in the northern woods of Wisconsin right now, which is really nice because when I left L.A., actually it was very early yesterday morning, but the day before, that would have been Monday, Los Angeles had the hottest day it has ever had in the history of the world. Or at least Los Angeles world, 121 degrees. That's like an OMG moment, right? Like, oh my goodness. And in Thousand Oaks, which is usually cooler, and it was only 111. But when I woke up this morning, it was 42 degrees? And I got up and put a little fire on for myself and got a little cozy while I had my time with the Lord and my coffee and my sourdough toast, and it was really, really nice. So it's been really sweet for a couple of days to be up here. I mean, if I have to shelter in place, I might as well shelter in our place in northern Wisconsin, and I'll be up here for a couple of weeks. My wife will join me in a week from today, actually, and stay another week with me. So I'll be 2.5 weeks up here about, and then be heading back. But I've got lots of work to do. I'll be doing some writing. A whole bunch of the story of reality was written right here in this cabin when I was all by my lonesome just doing my work. So I know how to manage here. And plus, I have a lot of friends here. In fact, this church I'm in right now is my church away from home, so to speak, EB Free Church of Woodruff. And I've spoken here every single summer for the last 25 years, except for this summer, because there wasn't no church, you know, because of what's going on. So it's just nice to be here. I got lots of friends here, and the restaurants are open, which is really nice. I don't have to wear a mask outside, which is really nice, especially since it's impossible to catch the disease out of doors. But that's another issue. Anyway, so it's relaxing here. I'm glad to be in the North Woods, and I'm glad to be chatting with you right now. And I realize I usually like to say something about my opening topic today earlier than I'm speaking now, because it has to do with kids going away to college, and a lot of kids are already gone, kind of. I mean, I think they've gone away, but they still have to work within their wherever they're staying, you know, kind of thing, because it's virtual for a while. But for in any event, they are in a new environment or going into a new environment when things loosen up. And I have some advice that I try to give every year that I think is important to heed in light of the challenges of being away in that environment. And by the way, those challenges are exacerbated much more now, especially after the events of this summer, than they have been, in previous years, though they've been still pretty bad. And I have a question actually was asked to me in another setting that I think is a good entree into the material and the kind of guidelines I want to offer regarding those who are Christian students going away to college, okay? And the question was that, the question offered me is that given my involvement with college students, what are the top three reasons that Christians fall out from their faith or their convictions, maybe choose another religion, become an atheist while they're away at university, and how can we help them get back with Christ? And to that general question, I had a couple of observations, and I'll close off with my kind of standard, okay, here are five things you got to keep in mind and kind of employ or act on or do something about if you are a Christian and you're moving into that kind of environment, a university setting. And in some sense, I'm not as well suited to answer this challenge as some speakers are. Frank Turek, for example, is on university campuses a lot. Now, I've spoken on more than 90 university campuses in the last 25 years. That's a lot, but it isn't like I do my – it's my main stock and trade. Frank is out there a lot. And then he's taking Q&A, and you can follow him on Facebook and watch him interact with the students. He takes a film crew with him everywhere he goes. So he's got his finger more on the pulse than I happen to. And I haven't actually engaged a lot of deconversion-type former Christians. But from polls that I've seen and the testimonies of those who have fallen away that I've read about, I do have a sense of some of the things that are going on. So I have a couple of thoughts. And here's the first one. Principally, Christians that lose their faith in college frequently never had much confidence in it to begin with. All right, mark that. In other words, they didn't lose their faith in college. They left it before they left their home and church group. I mean, the current data shows that those who jettison Christianity in college have already begun to fade in junior high and in high school, but they only go public with that when they enter into a secular environment like in the academy. I mean, they don't feel so safe, unfortunately, in expressing their doubts in their spiritual community. But once they're gone, they can express their doubts. They can indulge in their doubts. They can give in to their doubts. And nobody's going to give them a hard time for that until they come home at Thanksgiving or Christmas and then confess what's happened. But by then, they're probably so emboldened by their experience of other secularists at the university that they are not so responsive to thinking through some of the issues that have troubled them, okay? So the simple problem is here, we lose them early while they're still in church and under our watch. And we've learned this actually a number of years ago because when Frank Turek started CIA, 13 years ago, and I've worked with him every single year on this, it was because of this concern and kids in college who are Christian losing their faith in that environment. And so the idea was, let's build up speakers who can go into a college environment and help strengthen the Christians against the ideas that they're being pummeled with in the university. And we found out a few years later that it's too late by then. Not that those aren't good things to do and show up at the university and make the case and all of that. But if we're losing these kids in high school and in junior high school, that's where we need to be doing the work, which is one of the reasons that Stand to Reason is so committed now to passing the baton. And I got to thank Brett Kunkel for this because that wasn't really on my radar 10, 15 years ago. And it was on Brett's, though. And as an important player at Stand to Reason, he put the what was then called Rethink conferences together, now called Reality. And this kind of vivified my own concern for discipleship of the next generation. And I think of that passage in 2 Timothy, the second passage I remember memorizing as a brand new Christian. And again, I don't memorize verses as a rule. The verses that I have memorized, it's just through exposure and usage that they just stick. Thank God. I am not so good at the memorization stuff, but thank God that a whole lot of things are sticky. And one that stuck was 2 Timothy 2:2, which is easy to remember because all the two's in there. And Paul says, the things that you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, these entrust to faithful men who are able to teach others also. And so Paul identifies classically four generations of passing the baton. Discipleship, Paul to Timothy, to faithful people, then teaching others also. And so this is why we're committed to working with high school kids and committed to working with even middle schoolers. And this is the appeal of Reality, which, by the way, I don't have it right in front of me right now. But by the way, you know, Reality's coming up first in Seattle at the end of October, or is it mid-October? I'll get the dates for you shortly. And then in Minneapolis in November. And we are only able to take a limited number of people. In Minneapolis, we had 2,400 the first time around. Seattle, this is our first time around, and normally we'd probably have 1,500. But because of all the restrictions and everything, we can only take, I think, 400. That's the limit, you know, to get social distancing and all that stuff in the venue, at least in the Seattle area. And that's going to be in Bellevue, is precisely where the church is at. And I'll give you the skinny on that shortly. I'll look it up when we're having a break. But I just to let you know that you can't delay if you want to sign up because there's not going to be room. We can only take a limited number of people. We are stuck with that. And I think the number is 400. Is that right, Amy? Can you just nod at me? No, you don't know? Oh, she's talking to somebody else. Okay. But it's not like that. I'll get that to you also here shortly. But if you are interested in either venue, either October in the Seattle area, Bellevue, or in November in Minneapolis, just go to what, realityapologetics.com, I think it is, and sign up. I mean, you guys all know how great those events are and how we have the best speakers on the planet to address the tough issues, and we do it in a way that you can understand it. We throw the ball so you can catch it. You know that. We don't dumb it down, but through the skill of the communicators that we have, we, again, like I said, throw the ball so that you can catch it. I think we got J. Warner Wallace on board, in addition to the Stand to Reason crowd with Amy and me and, oh, I don't know about Tim because he's stuck in Canada and they won't let him out. We're going to see about Tim. But Alan will be there, of course, and I think Christopher Yuan, I'm not sure if he's on board this time or not, but Elisa Childers will be there, and she's just releasing her book, Progressive, no, see, Another Gospel on Progressive Christianity. It's a great lineup. It's an absolutely great lineup, okay? And I don't know that we're going to be able to do this online first time around. We haven't gotten up to speed on that. So if you're in the area and you want to go, you got to sign up, and you got to sign up quickly if you want to get in, or else we're going to be closed out. So just word of the wise, okay? But all of this as part of my point that we got to rescue, no, we've got to sustain, build up, strengthen, disciple our people, young, high school, middle school, before they're off facing the challenge of the university, which is tougher now than ever before. So that's the first observation with regards to this broader question, okay? And by the way, that I think the general reason that our young people are dropping out even before college is because, and we know this from the polls, they tell us, it isn't because they're a postmodern generation and they don't believe in truth. This is a false narrative. Yes, there is an influence of postmodernism and relativism, but ultimately, like all human beings, they're common sense realists. They live in God's world. They are made in the image of God. They are human beings are truth seekers by nature. And we believe truth when there are good reasons for it. Okay? Now, there are rebellious elements, and we sometimes resist whatever, but the big problem here is, and this is what we've learned, is that the questions they ask in church as teenagers were never answered. And they often were never even welcome. And so, since they had no good evidence, no good reason that Christianity was actually true, like capital T true, 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 like gravity is true, then they had no good reason to stick with it when the cultural pressure, especially in the university, pushed them away from Christianity rather than towards it. And they do this in a lot of different ways. Part of it is academically, part of it is morally, and I'll get to that in just a moment. Actually, that is my next point. The other issue that may initially surprise a lot of people until you think about it for a moment, and that is sex. One of the reasons our young people have a hard time staying Christian in the university is because of sex. I remember when I was a young man, I'd left my religious upbringing, such as it was. And when you're 18 years old and it's the mid 60s and you got this, the whole counterculture movement going on. I mean, and the hormones are flowing. The last thing you want to think about is virtue and God and self-restraint and purity and all of that. Not when there's all kinds of pleasures for the picking right available to you. All right. And so that becomes really difficult for young people. They leave an environment where they have some measure of accountability and encouragement to certain virtuous convictions, and then they move into a different environment where it's exactly the opposite, where the exact opposite behaviors are considered virtuous sexually, and there's not only no support or precious little support for their value system, but almost from every direction, they're hearing voices that are pushing them aggressively in another direction. And this is especially true for young ladies, because ladies have more of a native resistance in this area, because the consequences that befall them for reckless behavior are more severe. They can get pregnant. And so they're generally more careful, which means they need more persuasion. And the guys are willing to persuade, and there's all kinds of other things going on in the culture that are pushing against them, so it makes it a lot more difficult for them. So it's much easier to follow the rules when friends and family and youth leaders are looking over your shoulder. But when you move hundreds of or even thousands of miles away, everything changes. And there are few external incentives encouraging the Christian to be virtuous. There are few external incentives. That means the internal incentives, the internal commitments, the internal convictions have to be really strong. And to complicate matters, by the way, there's a recent refrain from non-Christians that if God really does exist, then unless he lets me do whatever I want with my body, whenever I want to do it, with whoever I want to do it, as many times as I want to do it, then God's not good. Okay? Maybe he exists, but he's not good because he doesn't let me have my fun. Well, God is good. And he wants his people to enjoy the fun of sexuality in the safest environment possible so it doesn't ruin their lives. And so the boundaries that he's put in there are boundaries of safety, not boundaries of like killjoy constraint. Anyway. That kind of attitude is compelling for young people to look for love in all the wrong places, okay, in that environment. One other thing that I want to mention that is, I think, a speed bump for young people when they go to college that are Christians is a host of issues regarding the Bible. And by the way, this is more so now than it has ever been before. There have been rejections about the Bible in the past, but for some reason, they seem to be front and center more than ever. And these are hard issues to address because they require thought. They require an ability to look at the big picture, to see the big picture scripturally, to understand certain things that, when taken in isolation, seem to be weird. Now, Dan Kimball is writing a book right now. Actually, he's already written it, and I've read a bunch of it and endorsed it. It'll be out in a couple of months, and I'm looking. I don't have it right here. It's something about the weird things in the Bible. Dan's great. He's got this ability to connect with the younger generation in a very authentic fashion. And sorry, I don't have the title right in front of me. Maybe I'll get it for you later. But But the book will be out in a couple of months, I imagine. But he's tackling all of these issues and in a real sympathetic way. Hey, I get it. I can understand why you'd be kind of taken by surprise by the, and I'm putting scare quotes around this word, slavery in the Bible, because that's probably the area that's the most seriously distorted as to what the Bible represents. All right. Or the patriarchy or the apparent ethnic cleansing and genocide that we see in certain places in rare circumstances or what I already mentioned, the sexual restraints. See, they these are tougher issues because they require big picture thinking about God's designs and also an understanding both of the purpose of the Mosaic Law, which almost nobody has, even fairly educated Christians, and also the prevailing cultural conditions of the ancient Near East that the law was speaking into and was in many cases improving. So what you see about what is largely indentured servanthood, unfortunately translated slave in much of the Old Testament text, and by the way, this is a recent 20th century development. Before the 20th century, the word eber in Hebrew was translated servant, not slave. By the way, it's the same word, okay? But it's a very different sense of things when it says servant as opposed to slave. I mean, Moses was the eber of God, the servant of God, but he owned ebers, slaves, that's the way it's put. And every time you say slave in American culture, there's all kinds of historical, cultural things that we remember from our own history and impose that on the text, thinking that's what was going on when it wasn't. All right. Now, this is just to say that these are challenging issues for young people to deal with if they don't have the depth and breadth of training. One of the reasons that Stand to Reason is here is so we can provide that for them. We can write about it. We can talk about it. In fact, I have a piece about this so-called genocide. And in fact, it's titled Judgment or Genocide? ? And we have it on our website. It's been there a long time. And I deal with the whole Canaanite issue and try to put that in its proper perspective so that people will understand. But you know what? Even understanding it properly and with depth and breadth, which takes a little work, it still doesn't mean it's going to be persuasive to the other side, because a lot of times the other side is not looking for a good answer. They're just looking for something to carp about because they don't want to bend their knee. Now, this isn't always the case, but I'm just saying. The important thing, as far as I'm concerned right now, is not that skeptic out there. It's that Christian who's confused. And this is why books like Paul Copan's Is God a Moral Monster, for example, answers a lot of these issues and puts them in the cultural perspective. And what we learn is that the Bible is an unbelievably liberating book when understood in the context of ancient Near Eastern culture. There is nothing like it in terms of the restraint that it puts on with indentured servanthood and the way women are treated and all kinds of other things too. So with that in mind, let me just offer five ideas or thoughts or guidelines here, and then we'll get to calls. Okay, if you're a college-bound student or you're there now, okay, these are the five things that you have to be alert to, okay? One of them is you got to pray. You got to keep praying, and you can't stop praying, and you got to pray every day. Why am I saying that? Because you're a Christian, because you're a follower of Christ. And you don't pray because somebody's looking over your shoulder, your youth leader, your disciple, or back at home is asking you about it. You pray because you love the Lord Jesus and you are living in the world that he made and you are following him. And in order to do that, you need to pray. And you need to do it regular. Now, I try to pray every morning. But sometimes I'm driving and I'm praying. And sometimes I don't get to pray. But I pray the next morning or whatever. But just keep in mind, you cannot do today's prayers tomorrow, because you can only do tomorrow's prayers tomorrow. And that's true with reading the Bible. And you want to, I'm just saying it again, because this is my refrain now for the rest of my life. I'm going to recommend read through the Bible continuously, always. little by little by little, check the boxes off till you're all the way through. If it takes you 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, that's okay. Just keep moving through it, reading carefully. And when you're done, start it again. And here's the reason, because the scripture, God's word, tells you what reality is like. You have access to reality. Your common sense notions will communicate a lot of reality to you. But most of what reality is like in terms of values and judgment about the way things ought to be, you're going to hear through every commercial, every TV show, every movie, every billboard, and every instructor that you're going to have. And this is the case even in many Christian schools. So you need to know what reality is actually like from God's perspective, because that's reality. It's not the philosophy of men. It's according to Christ, Colossians, 2:9 or whatever. So prayer, feeding yourself through the word on a regular basis. And I don't mean going to the Bible study once a week. I mean every day. You make it a daily habit. You eat? You eat food every day? Of course you do. You eat spiritual food every day. You don't live on bread alone, okay? Prayer, feeding yourself in the word, Christian community, absolutely vital. By the way, none of this is really magical. It's not like, here's the inside scoop, man. I got a secret for you. Prayer, Bible study, Christian community. Oh, man, where'd that come from? I never heard that before. He's on to the deep secrets. I am on to the deep secrets, but they're not hidden. They're the things that make the difference in the long run. You've got to find a community of Christians that you can be with on a regular basis that are also committed to Christ. All right? Do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. I just saw that verse, by the way, just before the show, driving right here in town in Woodruff, Wisconsin. It's on a billboard. And I think it was a protest against the state's restrictions about meeting in church. In any event, I think the churches are starting to open up here. Anyway, next week, this church will be inside. But they've been outside for a while, but now it's getting colder. Okay, Christian community, that includes accountability. People need to know who you are and what you're doing. You had somebody looking over your shoulder in some senses when you're back home. You need it here. Guess what? I need it here. I need it anywhere. We all need somebody looking over our shoulder that loves us and that's committed to Christ. All right? That's the third thing. Fourth thing, apologetics. If Christians' questions aren't answered, they can't answer the questions of non-Christians, and they get persuaded by the skeptics' doubts. That's why Stand to Reason is here. We're not alone. There's lots of other organizations that are available online. That's the quickest way to get anything. We have apps. We have quick reference apps, an app like that, and another Stand to Reason app. We have Solid Ground. We have mentoring letters. We got all kinds of stuff. We're producing. We got Red Pen Logic. You find it on YouTube. We're here for you, all right? We're here for you. And then keep in mind, how can I put this? Don't mess around with sex. That is the most destructive force in a university setting. You start messing around there, and that's when you have moral problems that cause theological problems. You start doubting, not because there aren't good answers to challenges, but because you have a conflict of interest now. Okay? Don't even get started there. Trust me on this one. Okay? All right, I've talked enough here. Prayer, feeding through the word, Christian community and accountability. 4, apologetics. 5, sex, but what I mean is don't do it. And that will keep you strong and sturdy in an increasingly difficult environment. Let's take a break and your calls when we return on Stand to Reason.
Why is the problem of evil still a problem for many skeptics and atheists? It's because they refuse to accept a fundamental reality that every Christian believes in. Find out what that is in this month's episode of my podcast, Thinking Out Loud. Look for it on iTunes, your favorite podcast app, or the top of the homepage at str.org.
Would you like a Stand to Reason speaker to speak at your church or event? Greg, Alan, Tim, and our newest apologist, John Noyes, are available, both in person and online. Just email booking@str.org to schedule them today. Our speakers can address a wide array of topics, from bioethics, gender issues, and science, to theology, philosophy, and how to respond to other worldviews, all from a biblical perspective. Whether it's a Sunday sermon, Zoom conference, or YouTube live event, our skilled and engaging speakers can be there, either physically or virtually, with the goal of equipping Christians to effectively influence the culture for Christ. To read their bios and learn more about the topics they cover, visit str.org. Then email booking@str.org to schedule Greg, Alan, Tim, or John today.
Hey friends, would you like to be encouraged throughout your week with timely, relevant content meant to bolster your knowledge, wisdom, and character? Or maybe you have a desire to be connected with other like-minded Christians from around the world. If so, then you need to follow Stand to Reason on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Not only will you be able to interact with other Stand to Reason followers, but you'll also stay up to date and informed on our latest resources and events. In our current culture, it's important to have something of value to break up your social media feed. So just visit str.org and find the links to all of our social media platforms at the bottom of the homepage.
Friends, Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. I wanted to give you that information I promised you. Washington, that will be Bellevue, which is just outside of Seattle, October 16 and 17. Those are the dates there. Minnesota, November 13 and 14. So we're basically dead center of both months in Washington and Minnesota. And Texas will be there February 26th and 27th of 21. You can go to realityapologetics.com to register and get all the further details. And by the way, some of you know about Red Pen Logic, RPL, all right? And that's on YouTube. And we've been doing, every couple of weeks we post something new. Tim Barnett is fabulous on this. Just so you know, go there, just look up Red Pen Logic. STR Live Book Club on STR's Facebook and on YouTube is starting once again Thursday, September 10th. That's in 2 days, all right? 2 days for me. All right. And that's going to be 1 p.m. Pacific time. And every other week, John and Alan and Tim discuss a book. They're doing The Universe Next Door by James Sire this time. Fabulous book. One you need to get as a standard part of your library if you want to understand world views. So anyway, just wanted to let you know that. And Amy, you just flashed me that title. Where is that? Can you give that to me? Or she's distracted with something else. How Not to Read Your Bible is the Dan Kimball book. There it is. How Not to Read the Bible, Making Sense of the Anti-Woman, Anti-Science, Pro-Violence, Pro-Slavery, and Other Crazy-Sounding Parts of Scripture. So just to recommend that, keep your eye open for when that comes out later this fall. And if you're a college student, that's going to answer a lot of the questions that you're going to be confronting when you're in class or talking with friends. All right, let's go to Joel in New York. Joel, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hey, Greg.
Hey.
So I think I have a question that's kind of like a philosophical question. Wrote it out.
I hate those philosophical questions.
I figured you probably could help me with it since you have the master's in philosophy. But I'm just going to read it. It's going to be easy that way. So I first said the correspondence theory defines truth as that which corresponds with reality.
Correct.
It seems to me that then in order to know truth, we need to have knowledge of reality. Knowledge
Correct.
Is usually defined as justified true belief. So it seems to have knowledge, we need justified true belief, but to have truth, we need knowledge of reality. And then I said, it seems that in order to claim we have knowledge, we need to have knowledge first. Don't we end up with circular reason here? I don't know if that made sense.
Okay.
But.
All right. Okay. Let me tell you what's going on here. Okay. What's going on is there's confusion because when we talk about the correspondence theory of truth, all right, all we are doing is defining a word. Okay. We're defining a word. We're defining what a word means. And actually, I don't even like the phrase correspondence theory of truth. And here's why. Because when you are defining words, the definition of words are not theories. They're either apt and appropriate characterizations of what people mean, or they're not. They're not theories. Okay.
Right.
There are actually other theories of truth, like the pragmatic theory. A thing is true if it works, or something like that. Or a thing is true if it coheres together. But those are in some ways fanciful. All right. When it comes to the so-called correspondence theory of truth, these are not, it's not a theory. It is a definition, a description of what people mean when they use the word. So if I told you, listen, Joel, I can come out to New York and I will take you out to dinner and answer any questions you want me to answer. And you said, wait a minute, you're not joshing me, are you? You're telling me the truth. Are you like putting me on, or are you telling me the truth? Okay, now, what do you mean when you use the word truth? What do you mean in that circumstance? You mean that the claim that I'm making fits the way reality actually is, or will be if I come out to see you. You know, you say, wait a minute, you're not lying, are you? So you're just using the opposite there to define the word. You're not lying, you're speaking straight, right? You're telling me the truth. So that is the correspondence understanding of the word truth. But notice that I'm not here, I'm going to give you a theory of truth and impose it upon our conversation. No, correspondence is a way of describing what people actually mean when they say truth, or they make some reference to the notion of truth. That's why I call it the garden variety definition of truth. And if somebody were to reject the correspondence theory, which, by the way, some people do, then I'm going to say, well, then you're going to have to come up with some other word to describe what other people are actually doing, you know, when they say things that are accurate, because that's what the word truth means. Okay, you still with me?
Yes.
Okay, I just had a little window that came up. I thought maybe I lost somebody, but to say that something the correspondence is just an attempt to show what people mean by the word truth. If we say that it is and it is, or we say that it isn't and it isn't, then that's what we mean by the word true. It's true then. There's nothing controversial about this. And if somebody said to me, the correspondence view of truth is false, and I asked him, is that true? He would say yes. But in other words, he'd have to employ that notion of truth to deny that notion of truth. Yes, it is actually factually the case that your definition is the wrong definition.
Right.
So now if we just understand that correspondence is not a theory, but it is a way of understanding what people mean when they say something is true. Okay, then we don't have any kind of conflict with the issue of knowledge. Because when it comes to knowledge, what knowledge is, and this is where the JTB comes in, justified true belief, what this means is that we have beliefs that are accurate. That's the true part. Beliefs that are accurate. What does that mean? It means that they fit the way the world really is. But they can't just be beliefs that are accurate, because you might have a belief that's accurate that you got by accident. So if you said, how many jelly beans is in that bag? You say, I believe there's 1,253. And maybe just by accident, you got them all right. Yeah, that's exactly what it was. Well, that wouldn't be knowledge, because you're just guessing. So there has to be more to believe it and have it be true. There has to be reasons why you believe it to be true to count as knowledge. Okay? So in that understanding that the word truth, when we use it, just means that our claims are accurate, and knowledge is when our claims are accurate and we believe that they're accurate and we have good reason to think they're accurate. There's no conflict then with any appearance of circularity.
So just to, because I feel like I might be still missing something. Are you, then it almost seems like you would say, based on what you just explained, that we can't, like to say I have knowledge of truth doesn't even make sense. Is that what you're saying? Like we can't even know truth? Like we just have truth, and then therefore based on that and justification, we can build knowledge?
Knowledge is, to say you have knowledge is to claim that you know something for good reason. So if you know something, let me back up and put it this way.
Believe
to say you have
something.
Knowledge, I use knowledge on both sides, so that's confusing. To claim you have knowledge is to believe a fact, which is truth, that you have good reason to believe. So truth, the ability the correspondence theory of truth, or if you use that language, or our understanding as truth as correspondence, is required for knowledge. If there is no truth as correspondence, there cannot be any knowledge. Because truth as correspondence is basically the statement, I know something about the way the world really is, or the world is a certain way, I believe it, and I have good reasons to believe it.
So would it make
sense then to say, to believe?
Would it make sense then to say that we don't know truth, but we behold truth? And then based on what we behold, combined with our beliefs, combined with justification, then we have knowledge?
No, I don't think it'd be fair to say
that. You see the problem that I'm trying to understand? Like, it just, if we don't know truth, I don't know, maybe I'm not articulating myself well, but it's just like if you say knowledge is justified true belief, then I might ask, like, all right, well, how do we know what truth is? But it sounds like you're saying we can't say that. It doesn't make sense. Truth is just
no,
that
we
can.
Which it we is. Can. No, we can. We know it because of our justification. Okay? I know I'm talking to you right now. I know that. It is true that I'm talking to you. I believe that I'm talking to you. But I don't just believe that I'm talking to you. I know that I'm talking to you, okay? And I know that I'm talking to you for a great number of reasons. One, I can hear you. Two, I can see on the computer it says Joel, New York. And it says a little note about correspondence theory of truth. Three, because I see Amy's face and she's also trustworthy and she wouldn't put that up there if it wasn't accurate, okay? So I got all these reasons to believe that I'm talking to Joel in New York about correspondence. In other words, I have knowledge of it. I have knowledge because it's true, and I know it's true because I have good reasons.
Okay.
I'm not sure what the confusion is.
Well, I guess maybe what I'm thinking then, based on what you just said, is that knowledge could even be more simply put justified belief, right? Because we
no.
True.
If you could have justified belief. You could have justified belief that doesn't amount to truth if it's not accurate, because
right.
There's different levels of justification. Look, there could be two people that are accused of a crime, and there could be evidence against each one regarding the crime. Okay, so you, based on the evidence in each one, you could be justified in believing one person committed the crime. And you can also be justified in believing the other person committed the crime, but you don't know which one it was because it can't be both of them. So you could have justification for both sides. But but it's not, unless what you're believing is the truth, it's not knowledge.
No, and that makes perfect sense to me. I guess I'm just getting hung up on, like, then how do we know truth? Like, but if we need truth in order to have knowledge.
No, you don't.
I mean, and I don't want to. Sorry.
Yeah, I get your point, and I think that there is a little hitch there, okay? Because but this is where the issue of justification is really significant, okay? And that is the stronger your justification is that the thing you believe is actually a fact, it's true, then the more confident you can be that you have knowledge regarding that thing. Okay? I think I have knowledge about God's existence. I think it's justified true belief. Now, could I be mistaken? Yes, we can be mistaken about almost anything. But that doesn't mean we can't say we have knowledge if our justification is really strong. And that's all the philosophic clarification is meant to do when it identifies knowledge as JTB, justified true belief, is meant to help us to hone in more precisely on what actually is true so that we can be more confident of the knowledge we have. Sometimes we think we know something and we're wrong. And then more evidence shows that, wow, that thing we believed wasn't true, which means all the time we thought we had knowledge about it, it wasn't really knowledge because it was not true. Has to be true to be knowledge. And then we learn maybe another take on it that is much better justified. And so there is a little bit of a tug of war there, a little heave-ho, but it doesn't mean that...
Yeah, do you see what I'm trying to like get at? I don't know.
I understand what you're getting at, but I will say that the correspondence definition of truth is not circular in the sense that you're concerned with. There is a certain sense that all definitions are tautological, which is a kind of circularity. So if I say a bachelor is an unmarried male... Well, that's just A equals A. It's the same on either side of the equation. So I've just repeated myself with different words. Correspondence truth correspondence is the view of truth that most people hold when they say, I think that's a true statement. So
it seems to me like, sorry.
Say again?
No, I was just going to say, it seems to me like, because I've been thinking about this kind of stuff more and studying and thinking like how we know things, it seems like maybe some of this comes back to even like what they call the properly basic beliefs or something, right?
Well,
like
that's one type of that's one type of justification. I actually think you're thinking a little too hard about it, personally. Okay,
I correspondence am.
Is the phrase correspondence theory of truth. I think is ill. Oh, what's the word I'm looking for? Ill put. It's not a theory of truth. It is what people mean by truth.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I think that maybe it's not the correspondence theory of truth that I think is circular. It's the JTB definition of knowledge that I'm thinking that.
Well, okay, I can see that. Well, it's not strictly circular. It's just not absolutely airtight. And there are people who have raised this issue. In fact, the question you are raising is the exact same question I raised when I heard the JTB definition of truth, of knowledge, rather, justified true belief. Because, you know, it seems like, well you could say you know something that turns out not to be true, even though it's well justified. And then it's not really knowledge. So when are you confident that what you believe is actually true? And
exactly.
And there are levels of that. There are just levels of that. But it's not circularity that you're dealing with. I think the definition is a good definition, but sometimes it's hard to know at what level of justification you need to be before you can say something is actually, you know that it's so. And proper basicality is a type of justification.
All right, thank you. And I'll have to re-listen and just kind of think a little more about it, but I think that helped a little bit.
Well, good. I'm glad you called, Joel. And, you know, I can see this is a little bit sticky, but just don't fall for the idea that correspondence is just a theory, because it's not. You know, it's
what people mean. That makes sense.
This would be like saying, you know, that this is the bachelor theory of unmarried males. One theory of unmarried males is that they're bachelors. Well, that's nonsense. That's what the word means, and it's the same thing here. Okay?
Yeah, and I like your garden variety, the way you say that. I think that's a better way to put it.
It's the garden variety definition. It's what everybody means. And then there are these more esoteric ways of talking about truth. Truth is as a coherence. Truth is pragmatics or something like that. And they have some use, but that isn't what people are talking about when they talk about truth. Okay?
Thank you, Greg.
All right, Joel, you're so welcome. And, you know, I'm looking at the clock right now. Wait, did I drop you or no? Go away.
Have a nice night.
Okay, you too. I'm trying to hang you up, but I can't. All right. Well, I don't know what happened. Oh, you're hanging yourself up. Why doesn't that work, Amos? All right. Well, I'm looking at my clock. It's probably good to just skip the break and go to Anthony in North Dakota. See if I can do this. Anthony and Well, you know, I'm having trouble with this. Okay, are you on, Anthony? The problem is I can't get rid of Joel. Joel, go away. Can you hang? Oops. There goes my Comrex.
Oh, am I
lost connection. Hello?
No. Yes,
okay, I just
Anthony
lost my connection to the server. So let me, I'm still on the air, right? Okay. Let me just reestablish that connection with my Comrex. And where is that? Bada boom. Okay, let me go to Anthony.
Yes.
Oh, we did it. Yes. Okay, it only took me about 60 seconds. Oh, I'm so proud of myself. Amy's smiling. Oh, look at, aren't you proud of me, Amy? I got myself out of that hole. Okay, Anthony, good to talk with you. And is that Bofano, North Dakota?
It's Botano. Yeah.
Did I say that right?
It's a hard one to pronounce.
Okay, well, glad to chat with you.
Yeah. Well, I had a question about hermeneutics. I'm thinking about leading a Sunday school class on this subject because it just concerns me that it seems like learning from you for many years that a lot of folks just kind of are at a loss of how to properly apply the truth of Scripture or to understand it, I guess. So my question was, is the author's meaning, the biblical authors, always the same thing as God's meaning?
I'm going to say a qualified yes, but I need to qualify it because it might be misunderstood. So sometimes an author is recording something that took place, and the thing that takes place are people who are giving their ideas about different things. And what God has done is he secured, through inspiration, the accuracy of that which is communicated. But a lot of times what is being communicated is a false idea about reality. So what is being communicated isn't God's meaning, it's the meaning of the speaker. In fact, I wonder if I can find this. I think I just read it in the Psalms. It's a really good example of a passage I think is probably misunderstood. Since I've just kind of gotten through the first 12 Psalms, I'm starting the beginning here. Let me see. I think that's where I saw it. Hold on. Oh, da 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 dee da dee. Because okay, here it is. It's Psalm 11. Okay, now listen to these words. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For behold, the wicked bend the bow. They make ready their arrow upon the string to shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? Now, I've actually heard verse 3 quoted by Christians as if this is God's advice or God's revelation. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? But that is part of a quotation of a naysayer that the psalmist is referring to. Back to verse 1.
Oh, right.
In the Lord, yeah. In the Lord I take refuge. How can you say to me, flee as a bird to your mountain, for behold, the wicked bend the bow, and they make ready the arrow upon the string to shoot in the darkness, the upright in heart, if the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? And then the psalmist responds, I'll tell you what the righteous can do. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked, and the one who loves violence, the kind that was just described, his soul hates, and upon the wicked he will rain snares. So basically the naysayer is saying, what are you going to do when everybody's against you? And the psalmist is saying, I'll tell you what I can do. I'm going to trust in God. Now, the reason I use this as an illustration is, one, I just read it a couple days ago. Two, I think it's frequently misunderstood. And three, it's misunderstood because there's a citation from a naysayer in the middle of a longer discussion that the naysayer's comments are sometimes taken as God's point of view when they're not. So back to your question, is the when you're interpreting Scripture, is the author's meaning always God's meaning? Well, in this case, no. It's a reporting of what the naysayer is saying. Now, when you take the psalm as a whole, well, then you could see the psalmist is making a particular point. I don't have to be afraid of these people. And what the psalmist's point is God's point.
Okay.
So the meaning is going to be resident in the author's intention. That's what we're after.
Okay, right there. Yeah.
And the sometimes the author is intending to make a point, like he does here in Psalm. Other time, it's a record of events, just general events that are taking place. I'm just looking at my clock, and I'm out of time here. My music is going goofy. So that'll do it for now. Okay, Doug, thanks for teaching the word to your friends and teaching them how to do so well. I'm Greg Kolkel for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.